Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're looking at changes that need to be made to the U.S. electric grid and how research at UW-Madison may influence some of those changes. We're going to be talking with you as well about electric vehicles, and we'll be taking your questions and comments from our with our guest today. Mary Blanchard, one of our guests. Mary is the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Mary, thanks for coming today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
With us as well, he's back, second trip back here. The last one was a couple of years ago, I think. Thomas Johns, Granger Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UW-Madison, very actively involved in renewable energy research in the areas of wind power, generators, electrical microgrids, sustainable buildings. We certainly talk about electric vehicles with him. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. I know they've done a lot of work on battery research, for one thing. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And Thomas, 2 years, hasn't it been?
I think that's about right. Time goes by very quickly.
Time goes by very quickly. And Mary, this is your first time here, if I'm not mistaken.
My first time on your show, yes.
Yeah, and the Wisconsin Energy Institute, I always like to start by talking a little bit about that. So tell us about the Energy Institute.
Sure. Well, we're really working to help solve one of the most critical challenges of our time, the transition to new, cleaner energy systems and solutions. So we work with scientists and engineers who are really committed to making major changes and breakthroughs in the way we source and use energy. So we really try to do three things. One is to foster collaborations on energy research across disciplines, so bringing together faculty members from across campus and even beyond to work on energy challenges, to prepare the energy leaders of today and tomorrow, and to enhance public understanding of energy issues. So we work with and have affiliates of more than 160 faculty members just on UW-Madison's campus.
It's really cool, and a lot of them have been on this show, because every other month or so we try and highlight something that's going on at the Energy Institute, and it's different faculty members every single time.
It's amazing to me the wide range of research that's happening here at UW. It's just a tremendous resource for the state and for the nation.
Yeah. It's important to say that it's more than just the science and engineering. I mean, the electric grid is a great example where it really does involve regulatory issues, business issues, economic issues. It's far more than just the engineering and science, as much as I love that. That's where an institution like the Wisconsin Energy Institute, I think, really makes a difference at a wide-ranging university such as we have here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the electric grid, somebody said, what's our electric grid? Can you define the electric grid?
Boy, it's literally so big that it almost defies a nice, concise definition, but it's been recognized by the world community as the largest machine in the world. I mean, when you think of it, it extends all the way from the tips of Alaska all the way down to the southern tip of South America, with very few, if any, breaks in between. And so it truly is a grid, an interconnected grid, that I think here in this country we're blessed that it's so good that a lot of us take it for granted. We just assume that it's always going to be there, except under very unusual conditions. And that's not the case in other parts of the world. And in some ways, we're kind of spoiled by that.
Yeah.
But it is an organism that continues to change. It has changed over our lifetimes. And there's factors underway that are probably accelerating that change. And so how can we change but still retain all the good things that we have about the grid right now? So
that's
part of the challenge.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, I think there are places like Hawaii where it's very expensive to bring in fuel, like diesel fuel, to run generators for electricity. And so they're looking to increase the renewable percentage in Hawaii. But there are challenges to doing that once you hit higher percentages of renewable, so like in the 50 to 100% range.
Yeah. As we look at the grid, what are some of the major problems with it? And we already have callers online. We'll get to Matt and Phil in a minute here, but do you want to talk a little bit about some of those problems, Thomas?
Well, it's like the comment I made about the grid. It gets to be very complicated. But there's a variety of different issues that come from different directions. One is the change in fuels that is happening. I mean, for many, many years, the dominant fuel that powered the electric grid was coal. And it's actually not renewable energy that's the dominant factor that's changing that right now. It's the huge breakthroughs that have come along with natural gas that have really changed the playing field, and there's a major transition now. It turns out that from a greenhouse gas standpoint that there are advantages to natural gas, but it's really being driven primarily by economic issues. There's just so much natural gas that's come about through fracking and the new technology that there's a shift that's going on, and so that creates all sorts of dynamic strains on the system. There are other challenges that having to do with cybersecurity, which shows up in so many places in our daily lives these days. But the electric grid being is in some ways, you might say, a sitting duck in the sense that it's a critical part of our infrastructure. Again, we take it for granted, but certainly to the extent that it goes away for an extended period of time, we'd know about it very quickly.
Indeed, we would. Well, let's take some calls. Matt in Wausau has a question for you, and let's just go there. Matt, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I've been thinking about this for some time. My question is, if I were to buy an all-electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid, would I actually be reducing emissions, assuming that the electricity that's being generated is generated by burning coal or natural gas?
Well, the answer to that, you put your finger on it. It depends on where you are in the country. It depends on where you are in the world. You're perfectly correct to bring up the so-called, the broad term is well to wheels. In other words, if you look at the overall energy path all the way from its very beginning when it's either taken out of the earth or whatever, all the way to its use, I mean, there's strong arguments that that's the appropriate way to look at it. And it is true that although electric vehicles by themselves, if it is a battery electric vehicle by itself, is really about as clean as you can get as a vehicle, that electricity comes from, well, again, it depends on where you are. Here in Wisconsin, we have over 50% of our electricity coming from coal. On the other hand, if you're in other states like California, or even, believe it or not, in our neighboring state, Iowa, over a third of all electricity comes from wind. And so depending on where you are, the math that lays out to what you know, where's the breakpoint will change. I do feel that there are some hidden issues. I mean, for those of us who are concerned about carbon footprints and emissions, that where some of those emissions are and how they're controlled does make a difference. And in a state like Wisconsin, where there are not annual inspections or whatever that keep close track of emissions, it's really a somewhat unregulated process, particularly as vehicles get older. Whereas power plants, like it or not, live in a regulatory world where there's been increasing pressure for them to clean up their emissions. So it's not only what the fuel is, but it's also who's processing it and to what degree are some of the negatives being addressed and controlled. So it's a complicated question, but it's one that I'm a technologist, and so looking ahead, and I think there's good reason to believe that the gradual penetration of renewable energy is going to continue to grow, and it only gets better. I mean, so even if in some location it may be a little marginal today, for those of us who believe in the technology, we see a bright future. We already see it happening, as I say, in some neighboring states and certainly in places like California and other parts of the world. And so I think that the future is with us, even though we're still clearly in a transition period right now.
All right. Matt, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Annette in Green Bay up next. Annette, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thanks. Great show always, Larry. All your shows are wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm kind of wondering about residential building construction, and I see so many new homes being constructed that have absolutely no windows for southern exposure. And for us in the northern areas, southern exposure in the wintertime is all this free sunshine, free warming, and it doesn't even seem to be on anybody's radar. And I'm surprised why there isn't a better mechanism to have builders consider the environment, you know, especially sun-free energy, when they build. For example, I just wanted to mention that in Germany they have a passive energy standard for all housing construction, so that houses that are new houses that are built, they essentially have to be, you know, zero energy and create their own energy. Why can't we do that in the United States, or at least in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
Thanks for the question. The issue of buildings is a very important part of the overall issue of energy usage. I mean, it's in terms of following the energy issue, it's not only how is the energy produced, but also how is it used. And it is true, as the caller suggested, there are parts of the world, Germany is an excellent example, where there's incredible attention being given to energy usage and in a building. And they're very proud that there's partly it's due to their relatively mild climate, but they have many buildings that are set up in so-called net zero. That is, they really have enough energy production within their building and use the energy that they have, and including solar, that efficiently, that they really don't need on average to import any energy from any source, including from the electric grid. Some of those techniques are gradually coming over into this country. In fact, Germany is, you might say, exporting some of that technology to bring it to North America and other parts of the world. And so, again, over the long term, I think there's really some wonderful opportunities and already some wonderful examples. But as the caller suggests, we've got a long way to go, and we're still in the early stages of really even coming close to tapping all the opportunities there are to learn how to use the energy we have more efficiently.
I'll just also add that there have been programs through a division of the Department of Energy called ARPA-E, which is focused on advanced technologies, to look at how do we utilize sensors better, especially in commercial buildings, in order to make sure that you're matching your energy use with where there really are people in the building, and that lowering it elsewhere, and certainly things like the Nest thermostat, which are trying to do a similar thing in residential buildings as well.
Good comments. Thanks again for calling. Phil and Mount Horeb, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm concerned about the proliferation of the high-voltage power lines that are being extended throughout the state. They're coming at great cost, as we're seeing in our fixed utility costs on our electric bills. Wisconsin, much of it, and certainly southwest Wisconsin, by the experts' own admissions, is in a very low to no growth electrical need for the next decade. The current lines are adequate for transmission. More transmission lines won't carry more than we currently use, whether that electricity is renewable energy or fossil fuel. I see these large 345 kilovolt lines going from city to city as institutionalizing the big fossil fuel power plants. We Energies has as much as 70% of its large power plants in coal and nuclear. I don't see why Wisconsin is pursuing a rapid. We've had six new lines in the last 8 years. They've come at terrific cost. They absolutely scar the environment. We're looking at a line going from Middleton to Dubuque, Iowa, that is going to make us look like just north of Chicago.
Thomas, do you want to comment on that?
Yes. In fact, if the caller would permit, I'm going to use it as an opportunity to bring up another larger issue that I think is very relevant. I will get back to this issue. And that's the issue of the difference between centralized power generation versus distributed power generation.
Yeah.
It's the difference between having a big wind farm or a big power plant, as we typically all our lives have known, out in the countryside someplace, that is feeding its power over transmission lines into urban areas and to its users, as opposed to, I guess, at the other extreme, our rooftop solar. If we have rooftop solar, You use the power that you need. If you have enough of it, you don't need, you have very limited need for transmission lines. And so there's a larger issue that is a very real issue. And you might say to some degree a competition, although I think as in most things in lives, it's not going to be a matter of one or the other. But I am a believer that there's tremendous opportunities and arguments for expanding the use of distributed energy sources and architectures. And if that is done, I mean, if you take it to its extreme, you realize that, well, if more of the energy is being produced where it's being used, the need for transmission lines is going to be reduced. In fact, in some parts of the country, utilities actually purposely are installing stored energy in order to stave off or at least delay the need for constructions of lines. So I won't comment on on any particular line here in Wisconsin, but I am a believer that in the longer term, the growth of more distributed configurations will gradually reduce the need. But I will comment that it's not a simple issue. I mean, if you look at where the wind is located, the wind is centralized and is best out in the middle of the Dakotas. And so if that's the case, then how do you get the power from there to here? And so that's where transmission lines become an issue, and it's hard to ignore them.
Yeah. Are there big challenges of incorporating renewable resources into the grid itself?
Yes, renewable energy is clearly I'm an advocate, but it's been recognized for a long time that it's, you might say, Achilles' heel is the fact that it is intermittent. I mean, the sun goes up, the sun goes down, the wind blows, the wind doesn't blow, and that's the same isn't true if you have either a nuclear power plant or even a coal power plant. Those are what referred to as base sources and will, you know, and really aren't sensitive, whereas the most typical renewable energies, probably with the exception of hydro, is not anywhere nearly as dependable. Even hydro has seasonal changes. And so the issue of how to deal with that intermittency is probably the number one overarching issue that faces us, technologists to solve, faces utilities in terms of how to manage that. And that is a major theme in terms of what we're doing and has a big impact on a lot of the things that are going on here at the university and elsewhere in the research community.
Yeah. Visiting today with Mary Blanchard, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and Thomas Johns, the Granger Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jane Rotunda, our producer, Sarah Hopeful, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the electric grid, renewable energy, with our two guests, Mary Blanchard and Thomas Johns. Thanks so much for joining us today. Questions for them, give a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I wanted to talk a little bit before we go back to the phones about electrical vehicles as well, just to get that into the conversation. We've got hybrids, we've got plug-in hybrids, we got battery electric vehicles, and you're working on pretty much all of them, aren't you?
Yes, there's different aspects of a technology that we're working on that really apply to all of them. It's as you say, it's a wide spectrum.
And do they all find their uses?
Well, there is a chronological process going on. Hybrid vehicles are, as the name suggests, are combinations of internal combustion engines plus electric machines and power electronics and batteries. In other words, electrical equipment that augments the internal combustion engine. And in the days when batteries were very expensive, the hybrid was a way to bring in the electrical equipment, but in a fractional sense. It only provided a fraction of the power required by the vehicle. But as time has gone by, batteries have gotten better. The technology regarding the rest of the electrical equipment has gotten better and better. And so hybrid vehicles gradually transitioned into what are today called plug-in hybrid vehicles, vehicles that can be run all electric, in some cases for for, you know, over 50 miles, but only when necessary, or when you're making a long trip longer than the battery charge would allow you to still have the confidence and the trust in having a fuel tank worth of gasoline to be able to make longer distances. But the ultimate, of course, in this string is to say, well, do we need the internal combustion engine? And that's where the full battery electric vehicles, where you no longer have any inkling of an internal combustion engine, it's all batteries. And of course, that means you need a bigger battery in order to give you anything approaching the range that you can get. So as time has gone by, the focus has gradually shifted over from hybrid to plug-in hybrid to now battery electric, and they all coexist. Each has their own advantage. But as time goes by, more and more of the spotlight is being focused on the battery electric vehicles.
Yeah. Mary, you were going to comment too, I thought, or maybe not.
No, I think what's really interesting about the research that Professor Johns does in the Wisconsin Energy Institute building, right, is really looking at battery systems overall, right? And so how the batteries interact with each other, how do you make sure that over time, if there was a battery failure in that system during one of the cells of it, how to make that work? And I also think another area, it's not exactly about electric vehicles, but about energy storage overall, is this need for a battery to provide power very quickly, and that a battery itself can provide more sustained power, but looking at ultracapacitors as a way of providing quick power in response to any drop in power.
Batteries are complicated structures, and they, everybody since ancient times, really, have been looking for the ideal battery, and it's still elusive. We're still looking for it. We've come a long way in the last several years, but some of the issues that were just mentioned, Mary just mentioned, are really critical to future growth and success. And there is good news. There is real progress that's being made in terms of how the batteries are designed, how they operate, the actual structures of the battery, the so-called electrochemistry, but also in terms of how we manage them, how we use them. Because typically, in something like a Tesla, some people may know this, but those vehicles actually have not one, not two, but over 7,000 batteries. Each one is kind of like a AA cell, So it's so in the case of Tesla, they followed that route. But you can imagine, if you have that many batteries all connected up, how do we know what's going on? Are they all in good shape? There's major issues that have to do not only with what's inside the battery, but what happens when we put them together, and how do we manage them to keep them healthy and to know where they are, to have the equivalent of a fuel gauge. I mean, we want to know how much energy is there, and those things are not trivial to do. It's not as simple as having the equivalent of a dipstick in your fuel tank to know how deep the fuel is. It gets to be more complicated when you have something like a battery that has to we have to know what its electrochemical state is to know essentially how much energy it still has left.
You think we'll have all electric? I mean, that all the vehicles will be electric at some point in 100 years from now, maybe 50.
Well, again, I'm a technologist, so I am an optimist, and I see trends that are moving in that direction. It's like a lot of technologies. I mean, their death can be greatly exaggerated, and internal combustion engine has and gasoline as its powering fuel is hard to beat in terms of some of the properties and the range that it provides. So this is not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen completely anytime soon. However, I there's clear that it's not only in terms of vehicles; it's the land, the sea, and believe it or not, in the air, that all of these modes of transportation are moving in directions of electrification. And it really is astounding how far we've come, and some of the serious efforts that are underway, even in the world of aviation, to look at the opportunities for having, and again, kind of like first hybridized aircraft, but eventually all electric aircraft that first will be for short ranges, but as batteries get better, dreams of being able to use them them for even, you know, longer trips. So it's an exciting field to be in the sense that really every mode of transportation is being affected one way or another by this. And certainly one of them that we see on the road in front of us is the battery electric vehicle, but it's going on in all of these other environments as well.
Yeah. I'll just add that I think that a lot will depend on the availability of materials, right, and new battery chemistries, as Professor Johns mentioned, so that maybe different types of battery chemistries for different purposes. But here we are dreaming to have electric vehicles, electric airplanes, but then also to use batteries for grid-level storage as well. And so we'll really need a lot of innovation on the battery chemistry side so that we can be able to mine and develop these batteries to meet all these applications.
Yeah, makes sense. Let's take another call. Vern and Stanley, it's your turn. Thanks for waiting, Vern. What's on your mind?
Okay. Now, when you drill your sand frack for oil and methane, you go into granite, like in South Dakota, I guess, you run into radon. What do they plan to do with all the radon you run into and the radium? Because a lot of this bedrock is radioactive.
Well, this is a topic which I have to admit is beyond my expertise to answer precisely. I mean, there are techniques that it has a lot to do with where those particular minerals are and fuels are being mined. The amount of radon, the amount of radium, it's very sensitive to where that is where in fact that mining is going on. You know, in the long run, I have to admit I'm exposing my own bias, but as time goes by and we get to the point where we don't need as much of some of those fossil fuels, I mean, to some degree, the problem abates. Again, I don't mean to sound naive. I mean, we're always going to have to be mining. There's always going to be side effects, and we always have to be, speaking very broadly, very concerned about making sure that the health of the miners who are working on, as well as the general public, are not exposed to those dangers any more than necessary. But there's some of these problems just don't have simple answers, and I think that some of the changes are going to come about because of larger changes that are going on. That as is what is happening in coal right now is just as less coal is being used, it means there's less fewer mines that are active, and the same is true in some of these other areas where there are undesired side effects that go along with and it was a point that I was making before we got on the air, which is, you know, if we're addicted to energy, we all expect the lights to go on, but there's no source of energy that doesn't have some accompanying side effect, often undesirable, that we have to manage. And we argue over which of these has the best assets and the fewest disadvantages. But the search for trying to find that absolutely clean fuel that has absolutely no side effects, that is probably unobtainium, as we would say. So it's tough, and so we have to learn to manage the risks that we're dealing with, whether it's the spent fuel of nuclear power, or whether it is the side effects that come along with each of these different types of fuels the greenhouse gases that come along with the fossil fuels.
Vern, thanks. Let's go to Sarah in Zion, Illinois next. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. You know, okay, I thought of another question, but I guess I'll forget it. I just recently read about a man named Paul Hellyer, who I guess was a Canadian Minister of Defense in the 70s, and he died recently, but he spent the rest of his career writing about public policy, including energy, and he says that there are sources, technology that exists right now to meet all energy needs with renewable energies, but that corporations in the fossil fuel industry have suppressed it and have bought off all and governments going along with it because of they're in control of corporations. I just wondered if you have even heard of this guy.
I've heard the name, but the idea of going to completely renewable energy, to clean energies, is an idea that continues to be discussed around the world. And again, I'm exposing my own bias, but there's no law of physics that that says that we can't get to a world in which we can, let's face it, all of our energy comes from the sun one way or another, whether it comes in the form of coal or whether it comes more directly in terms of sunshine that gets converted directly into via photovoltaic into electricity. And there's the energy is there. And as the technology gets better and better, the at least the opportunities for moving to a completely renewable energy economy gradually get better. But I mentioned starting off that the electric grid is the largest machine in the world, and that means there's an incredible amount of infrastructure, which even if we were to decide today to change it, would take time. That being said, it's like any technology where there's been a lot of investment, whenever you make changes, there's people that win from that, other people's that will get hurt in the short term, and I'm well aware of that. The issue of how to manage that, these transitions, in such a way that we can come as close as possible to having everybody being a winner, that's the objective. It's never quite reachable, but I think there's a lot that we can do if we all agree on the objective. And some parts of the world, that kind of consensus has been reached. I mean, believe it or not, there are countries like Iceland that are completely renewable energy. They're an exception because of all of the geothermal they have. But if you go to other places that aren't that far away from, that are also over in that part of the world, I mean, Denmark is already at approaching 50% of its energy from renewable energy, with targets of reaching 100%. So this is not purely just a few crank authors out there. There's parts of the world where they're really serious about that, and even within this country, there's parts of the country where there's where there is a stronger consensus and much more active efforts underway in order to try to approach or at least move in the direction of completely renewable energy.
Yeah, thank you again, Sarah, for calling. We'll give Ron in La Crosse a chance to join in. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I was just wondering about this business with coronal mass ejections from the sun. These astrophysicists, it did happen way back in 1859. Back then, the only man-made electrical device was the telegraph. A couple of telegraphers were severely burned. But is the power grid and the power companies going to do anything about that?
Thank you for the question. It is a pretty specialized question, but it is a very real one. The sun is both our friend and at times can be our enemy. As we know, there are times when the sun is very active, and as a result, it's not only emitting visible light, but it's emitting incredible amounts of other electromagnetic emissions, which from the standpoint of the sun, the transmission lines on Earth look like a big antenna. And so that antenna can pick up that power, and this amount of energy can overwhelm it. And so there are no quick fixes about that. The utilities are aware of that and do take steps to try to at least limit the damage. But again, I would make the point, coming back to one that I made earlier, is that as we move to a more distributed grid, that is where the energy is made locally, well, then the number and the amount of transmission lines that we have out there that would serve to be, as the antennas and would be vulnerable to this would gradually decrease. So it's another, not the primary, but certainly a secondary benefit of moving to a more distributed system. But that problem of the sun is, it's both our biggest friend, but we do have to respect it. And that's one of the specific ways that the sun can show us who's boss and remind us that there's a lot of energy there that sometimes isn't always controlled in the nice level even way that we might hope it would be.
Yeah, I'll just add one more thing, which is I know that there have been hearings on electromagnetic pulses at Washington, D.C., and Congress has had hearings, and that they're also in some of the national labs. This is an area that they're monitoring as well.
And thanks again for that question, Ron. Appreciate it. John in Highland, your turn. Hi, John.
Good morning, Larry. Hi, and to the guests. I have a comment that I'm looking for a return comment, I guess, on here. I, too, am from out in the Driftless area where we're concerned about the high voltage lines going up everywhere and the hint that 5, 6, 7, 10 more might be going up. And I have come across in the past months from the Department of Energy through Lawrence Livermore Labs, there is an audit done every year, and your guest is talking about efficiencies and inefficiencies. And starting in 1970, when they first did this, they discovered, looking at every source of energy creation, which goes all the way from a very small percentage of, like, geothermal and back then solar, all the way up to the big guns, nuclear and coal, and now, of course, natural gas. And in 1970, we created, in the United States, twice the amount of energy that we used. As time has gone on, and especially into the 90s, when we started building more and more plants and more long-distance distribution, we now create, because we're so good at it, two-thirds more energy than is used every year in the United States. And that has continued to be, follow that curve. It has not, it hasn't changed much in the last 20 years.
That question is I think it would probably take some more discussion because there's a difference between capacity, and certainly it's true that the capacity of, and if we talk about the electric grid, of producing power is larger than what we need, and you always want to have some margin. And that's something that our utilities and the public service commissions manage to make sure that there is a safe margin, but not too much. But ultimately, the laws of physics apply. At any one time, roughly the amount of electricity that's being generated is pretty close to the amount that's being used at that instant, frankly, because we don't have a good way to be able to store that. And that is a larger issue. But the issue of how to manage our electric grid and manage it in a way that really is optimum in a sense really is a very, very, very challenging issue, and one that right now is handled by each state individually with some inputs from the federal government.
And, boy, on that note, we are about out of time here. It's been, I hope you'll come back and be with us again to talk some more about this. Obviously, there's a lot of interest among our listeners, and appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, Larry. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We'll have them back, and we'll talk with them again. There's obviously plenty of things to discuss with our two guests, Mary Blanchard, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and Thomas Johns, Granger Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UW-Madison, very actively involved in renewable energy research. So it's great to have them with us, and we will have them back, and we'll do this all over again. And we're moving on a little bit, and we're going to switch gears. As we often do on this program, we're going to go from energy to food a little bit. You know, you can find food it's all around us. A lot of people are becoming foragers, and we're going to be talking with our next guest about mushrooms. When it comes to mushrooms, you may still hesitate a little bit when you see a mushroom out there. I certainly do. Our guests have a great new book. It's called Untamed Mushrooms, From Field to table, and we'll talk with them next on the Ideas Network.